We'll turn to 1 Kings chapter 18. And we're dividing it into six areas. This is the challenge of Elijah on Mount Carmel. Verses 17 and 18, he makes the accusation, Ahab, you're the problem. In verses 19 and 20, he makes the request to gather together all the prophets of Baal and the entire nation. And then as he addresses Israel, he gives them the challenge of verse 21. How long will you hesitate between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, followed him. Then you have his proposal, which breaks into two parts, and that's where we stopped this morning. The proposal is in two parts. Elijah's proposal, which is in verses 22 through 29. And we will have A, the statement of it, which occurs in verses 22, 23, and 24. And then under the proposal made, we will have a suggested procedure of how we are going to determine who is God. And that's in verse 22-23, reading. Verse 22, Elijah said to the people, I alone am left a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Now, let them give us two oxen. Let them choose one ox for themselves and cut it up and place it on the wood, but put no fire under it, and I will prepare the other ox, lay it on the wood, and I will not put a fire under it. And that is the procedure that is to follow. Then in verse 24, you have the test, and we'll spend a lot of time with this tonight. The test is in verse 24. It says, then you call on the name of your God, Baal, and I will call on the name of the Lord, or Jehovah, and the God who answers by fire. And that's what we want to spend a little time with tonight. The God who answers by fire, he is God. And all the people answered and said, that is a good idea. So then, from there on out, 25 through 29, we will have, following the statement of it, we will have the execution of it. They'll actually do it. And that follows again in 25 through 29. But before we get to that, we want to spend some time on the fact that about 11 places in the Word of God, God answers by fire. And we'll want to see where these things occur, and we'll want to look at why God intervened in that particular way and what is the lesson being taught. And so we'll divide them into categories of looking at these appearances and saying, why did God do it? The first reason, and let's put it down first and then we will go to the passage. The first one is God answers with fire when? In fact, every one of our points here will begin the same way of saying God answers with fire when certain conditions exist. So first of all, God answers with fire when man has ignored him. God answers with fire often when man has ignored or disobeyed him. Both of those things really rooted together. God is ignored and disobedience obviously follows. God answers by fire when man has ignored or disobeyed him. And underneath that, let's go to our first passage. Basically, what these things will be, they will be attention getters. They will be God saying, look, you are ignoring me. I am alive and I am here. In other words, they will be dramatic displays saying that even though I may be silent, I'm not dead, I am very much alive. And let's go to the first, Genesis 3, 24. Genesis 3, 24. On rare but very dramatic occasions, God says, you have disregarded my word, you have ignored me, you have acted as though I were dead. I am not dead, I'm very much alive, and he makes a dramatic fire-type appearance. Chapter 3, verse 24 is the first. Of God it says, he drove them, that would be Adam and Eve, or the man out, and at the east of the Garden of Eden he stationed the cherubim and the flashing sword which turned every direction to guard the way of the tree of life. So the flaming sword is the first appearance, and basically it is there for one reason. it is there as a reminder that sin has entered the universe. It's a reminder that sin has entered. How did God respond to the sin of Adam and Eve that ignored and disobeyed Him? He responded to that by a flaming sword. Sin has entered the universe. Also, note that that sword guarded the way of the tree of life. So it's a second reminder. It's not only a reminder that sin has entered, it's also a reminder that sin has blocked the tree of life. And those are important things. God's appearances as far as fire are concerned are dramatic. They carry lots of significance. That's why they're rare. Adam and Eve sins, and God says, I want a permanent reminder, and I am going to respond by fire. And as that was seen, was a reminder every day, I have been dishonored. I've been disobeyed, and He puts the sword there to remind the world of that and also to show that something tragic has happened. Your disobedience, your ignoring of what I demand of you has blocked the way of the tree of life. The second one is in Genesis 19. Second is Genesis 19. And it, again, is in the context of God has been ignored. And He responds by fire. Genesis 19 and verse 24, let's look at the occurrence first. Verse 24 says, Then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. Basically, we've had in chapter 18 and 19 of Genesis the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah. And basically, the fire appearance here is saying, I have been ignored and I am not indifferent to social sins. God is not indifferent to social sin. Chapter 19 and verse 24. Now let's go back just a bit. Go back to chapter 18, verses 20 and 21. Basically, Sodom had ignored God. But there is a very important principle here, and it's this. When a society ignores God, they are screaming at God. When we turn our back as though He didn't exist, that in itself is a screaming, bloody message. And notice the way it is. They were living as though God did not exist. And God took personal offense to that, going back to chapter 18, verse 20. The Lord said, The outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah. What's it called? An outcry. And what were they doing? They were living as though God did not exist. And God says that screams. You tend to think that when you're silent and you ignore somebody, that you're not giving a message. And God says the message of Sodom that ignored me screams in my ears. And verse 21, I will go down now and see if they have done entirely according to its outcry, which has come to me, and if not, I will know. Well, so we have the principle then, when men ignore God, go their own way, that creates an outcry or a scream in heaven, and God is going to respond to that in this context by fire. The second thing that is taught by the Sodom and Gomorrah incident is the fact that God's judgment is perfectly righteous. He does not allow the righteous to perish with the wicked. It is absolutely righteous. You come down to verse 23, and Abraham raises that subject. He says, Abraham came near and said, Will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there are 50 within the city. Will you indeed sweep it away and not spare the place for the sake of 50? This is not bargaining. Abraham is not trying to jew God. He's not saying, how about 50? And how about 40? Well, if you go for 40, would you go for 30? That's not the point at all. The point that is involved is he is showing that God will not even let one single person perish along with the righteous. And you come down finally to the end of chapter 19, and he says, if there are 10, and God says, I will not punish it if there are even 10 righteous. Finally, we come over to 19 and 16. and you find out how many righteous there were in Sodom. How many were there? God tells them to get out. It says he hesitated, speaking of Lot. So the men seized his hand and the hand of his wife and the hands of his daughters. So that's 1, 2, 3, 4. For the compassion of the Lord was upon them, and they brought them out and put them outside the city. There were 4 righteous in Sodom, and God saved all 4. It's interesting, of course, that in verse 17, or rather in the verse we just read, that they had to be dragged out. God's judgment is righteous. The righteous will not perish with the wicked, even if we have to drag them out, which they did in the case of Lot and his wife in chapter 19. One other latent lesson, I think, is there. The citizens of Sodom had merely exercised their right to their own personal sexual preference, and God responded with fire. Next, Leviticus chapter 10. This one hardly needs any comment. Notice the pattern in all of these. God has been obeyed or he has been ignored, and he responds to it. Leviticus 10. Nadab and Abihu got a little bit loose in recognizing the way God wanted things done. They ignored his word, and they concocted their own little affair here, and notice the way God responds. Chapter 10, verse 1. Now Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took their respective fire pans, and after putting fire in them, placed incense on it and offered strange fire before the Lord. Strange fire simply means they offered fire that the Lord had not commanded. In other words, they played loose with God's regulations. They were acting as though he didn't care. He's not there. He's not involved in this. And so, verse 2, God answers them with fire. It says, fire came out of the presence of the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. That had to be an enormous shock. We thought he was dead. We thought God wasn't looking. We thought we could ignore him. And notice the remark in verse 3, then Moses said to Aaron, it is what the Lord spoke, saying, by those who come near me, I will be treated as holy. And before all the people, I will be honored. And again, that speaks for itself. God was ignored, and God responded by fire. Numbers 16. Numbers 16. I know it's ridiculous, and I know the commercial is not on, but in going through these sections, I keep getting in my mind, what was the ad for? Was it for Bluebonnet? That you can't fool Mother Nature, broom, you know. And that's what you think of with Nadab and Abihu. They tried to fool God or play loosely with his word, and broom. And we're studying the brooms. Okay. Taking a look at them. Number 16. Korah and others have got some problems with leadership. They really prefer a more democratic way of doing things. They feel that everybody is equal and leadership is not really valid. So verse 2. Korah and several others, 250 of them, rose up before Moses together with some of the sons of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, chosen in the assembly, men of renown, and they assembled themselves together against Moses and Aaron and said to him, we've had it with your leadership. We want democracy. Everyone is created equal, and all the people could be leaders. And notice, in essence, that's what they're going to say. You have gone far enough, for all the congregation are holy. Everyone is equal. Every one of them, and the Lord is in their midst, so why do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord? In other words, we object to your leadership. You have the same thing coming down to verse 13. Moses attempts to summon some of them, and they say in verse 13, is it not enough that you have brought us up out of the land flowing with milk and honey to have us die in the wilderness, but would you also lord it over us? We don't want your leadership. Now, how does God respond to that? Well, in ignoring the leadership of Moses, you are ignoring the leadership of God, and the latent result comes down to 16 and verse 35. God answers their rejection of His leadership and responds by fire. Verse 35, fire also came forth from the Lord and consumed 250 men who were offering the incense. You get the little idea that God is saying, you can go along, you can play loosely, you can pretend that I'm not there, you can disobey me, but one day my patience is done. And can you, I get the image here, whether any of you have one of these, but what are those things out in the backyard that they crack and pop all night? It's purple light, they zap bugs. Someone about a half a block down from us has got one of those things. And do you ever get used to them? All I can hear all evening is zap, 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 zap. But at any rate, I think of that when you come down to verse 35. Here are these 250 pretending as though God doesn't exist and zap 250 bugs. Okay? So that then is the first category of passages. Often in the Old Testament, God would answer with fire when man had ignored or disobeyed Him or played as though He did not exist or treated His word lightly. Now, as you notice, that's not all 11 of them, because there are other reasons why God appears in fire. And the second one is God answers by fire when or to display His holiness. God answers by fire to display the fact that He is holy, and man has forgotten it or needs to be reminded of it. God responds or answers by fire to display the fact that He is holy. And for that, let's go to Exodus 3. Exodus 3. And in the Exodus 3, 1 through 3 passage, we've got another appearance of God by fire. It says, Moses was pasturing the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, to the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire from the midst of the bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, yet the bush was not consumed. So Moses said, I must turn aside now and see this marvelous sight, why the bush is not burned up. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses, he said, here am I. Then he said, do not come near here. Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. And so notice here, number one, the fire indicated His holiness. Second, the fire did not go out. God is eternally holy. It never diminishes. He never is less holy. And finally, He says to Moses, because I am holy, the fire constitutes a no trespassing sign. Don't come near. So the fire is a no trespassing sign. But the essence of all of it is, God is saying, I am holy. Exodus 19. Exodus 19. Exodus 19. Notice the same message is coming across. First category passages are saying, I'm alive and I won't be ignored. The second category is saying, I'm alive and I am holy. Chapter 19, verses 10 through 12. The Lord said to Moses, this is for the giving of the law, go to the people, consecrate them today and tomorrow, let them wash their garments. Let them be ready for the third day, for on the third day the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. And you shall set bounds for the people all around, saying, beware that you do not go up on the mountain nor touch the border of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. And then you come down to His appearance in verse 16. So it came about on the third day when it was morning, that there were thunder and lightning flashes and a thick cloud upon the mountain and a very loud trumpet sound, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. And again, in verse 18, Mount Sinai was all in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire. And again, the whole message is, I am holy, no trespassing, you cannot come near my presence. Third passage with the same thing, or third group of passages, is, remember, number one, to remind man that I am here. Number two, to remind man that I am holy. There's a third use of this, and that third category is to show his approval. God can appear in fire to show his approval. For that, 2 Chronicles 7. 2 Chronicles 7. One of the 11 appearances of God by fire, 2 Chronicles 7, verses 1 through 3. 2 Chronicles 7, 1 through 3. We're at the dedication of the temple, and God is going to display dramatically that I approve of what's going on. When Solomon had finished praying, fire came down from heaven and consumed the burnt offering and the sacrifices, and the glory of the Lord filled the house. And the priests could not enter into the house of the Lord because the glory of the Lord filled the house. But notice the emphasis here is, this is my house and I approve of what's being done. He comes down and he consumes the sacrifice. The fourth category is, God answers by fire to give assurance of his presence, or to give assurance of his faithfulness. I will do what I say. I think it goes without saying that an appearance by fire would get your attention, obviously grab you. Chapter 15 of Genesis. Oh, by the way, they haven't all occurred yet. There's one coming, and it will have the same measure of surprise that all of the past ones had. The last one will be saying, I will be ignored no longer. Genesis 15, verse 12. Back at verse 12, God has made an agreement with Abraham called the Abrahamic Covenant. And Abraham has a problem. He wants to know for sure that he wants assurance. And God is going to respond in verse 12. When the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell on Abram. And behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. And God said to Abraham, know for certain. In other words, I am aiming to give you an assurance that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and so forth and so forth. Then you come down to verse 17. It came about, God's trying to give him assurance now, it came about when the sun had set that it was very dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven and flaming torch which passed between the pieces. In essence, we've explained this previously, one of the ways in those times of making an agreement was to make a sacrifice, cut the animal in two parts, leave an aisle down the middle, and one party would walk through, the other party would walk through, and that would be saying, we signed a contract. We both agree, I will keep my part of the contract, you keep yours. The interesting thing here is, party one, who is God, and party two, Abraham, is asleep. God anesthetizes him, puts him to sleep, and God himself walks through the midst of the pieces, which is essentially saying, I'm responsible for the fulfillment of it. And when he did so, in verse 17, this was by means of a flaming fire. All right, fifth, God answers by fire to signal the beginning of a new age. It's one of God's, part of God's repertoire for opening a new age. He did it at Sinai, and as you know, in Acts chapter 2, with the opening of the church age, or a new era, you had fire. One of the chief characteristics. Verse 1 of Acts 2, when the day of Pentecost had come, they were together in one place, Suddenly there came from heaven a noise like a violent rushing wind. It filled the whole house where they were sitting, and there appeared to each of them tongues as of fire, distributing themselves and rested on each one of them. It signals the beginning of a new age. And sixth and finally. No, let's just use this as a sub-point. Let's put the one past, which is Pentecost, Acts 2. And future, which is 2 Peter 3, 10 through 12. 2 Peter 3, 10 through 12 is our final one. This is future. Another age will sometimes come. We have had the church age. It will be followed by what is called the day of the Lord. And in verse 10, it says, the day of the Lord will come like a thief, in which this is God's final fireworks display, in which the heavens will pass away with a roar, and the elements will be destroyed with intense heat, and the earth and the work shall be burned up, since all these things ought to be destroyed in this way. What sort of people ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, on account of which the heavens will be destroyed by burning and the elements will melt with intense heat? And it will be God's final word, I will be ignored no longer. All right, now let's go back to 1 Kings 18. We had the proposal made. Who is going to answer by fire? Which of the categories would you put this in? I'd put it in the first one, wouldn't you? God is saying, I've been ignored as long as I'm going to be ignored in Israel. I have tolerated the Baal worship as long as I will tolerate it, and I'm going to break in, and I'm going to give my answer as to my existence by fire. And he does so. So down at verse 25. So Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, choose one ox for yourselves, prepare it first for your many, call on the name of your God, but put no fire under it. So they take the ox that was given to them, they prepared it and called on the name of Baal from morning till noon, saying, O Baal, answer us. And so notice you have, again here on their part, what we might call religious mentality. And the religious mentality they have is this. Man somehow can do something to appease God. That's the format of it. Man by himself can appease God. That stands, of course, in complete contrast to Christian mentality. Christian mentality says we cannot do anything to appease God, and all of the appeasing of God is done by someone else for us. What is that called? The doctrine of propitiation. Simply says, I cannot satisfy and appease God for my sins. Jesus Christ is the only one that can, and that's the doctrine of propitiation. But religious mentality says we can do it. And basically, the prophets of Baal are going to go along three lines. Number one, our persistence will move God. Second, our enthusiasm will move God. Third, our sacrifice, which we make, will move God. Now let's see that. First of all, our persistence. Verse 26. Then they took the ox which was given them, and they prepared it, and called on the name of Baal from morning till noon. Persistence. Saying, O Baal, answer us. But there was no voice, and no one answered. And so they continue with the persistence, and maybe God will respond to our enthusiasm. We'll jump up and down and wave our arms. That still may linger with us. And they leaped about the altar which they made. And you can picture the scene. You know, we've got to get his attention. So here's the picture of them jumping up and down on the altar. That's enthusiasm. They're going to jump up and down, and that will impress God. And then finally, in verse 28, they cried with a loud voice, cut themselves according to their custom, with swords and lances till the blood gushed out on them. In other words, God will be impressed when he sees my blood. God will be impressed with my sweat. And that's all religious mentality and what happens to it. How is Elijah going to handle this? You know how he's going to handle this? He's going to say, I really appreciate your sincerity, and I'm really pulling for you. How's he going to respond to this? He's going to respond to this by ridicule. And notice the ridicule in verse 27. You can't say anything except this is ridicule. Elijah's apparently having a ball, watching this scene, watching them jump on the altar. And it came, verse 27, about at noon, that Elijah mocked them and said, call out with a loud voice, for he's God. Either he's occupied, he might be on the phone. He's occupied or gone aside, or maybe he's on a journey. Or perhaps he's asleep and he needs to waken him. So Elijah's sitting there, the cheering squad, saying, you know, jump a little bit higher, cut a little bit deeper, yell a little bit better. That is the style of the Old Testament. The style of the Old Testament in respect to idolatry is always ridicule. Let me give you a section you might be interested in reading. I will not read all of it, but look at Isaiah 44. Isaiah 44, and you'll pick up the Old Testament flavor. It's a good chapter on idolatry. Isaiah 44, verse 6. It's a good passage to go along with the... It's a good monotheism passage, again, that there's one God, and the true God is the Jehovah of the Old Testament. Verse 6, chapter 44. Thus says the Lord, the King of Israel and his Redeemer, the Lord of hosts, I am the first and I am the last, and there is no God besides me. Who is like me? Let him proclaim and declare it. Come on, competitors, I'm ready. Yet let him recount it to me in order. From the time that I established the ancient nation, let them declare to them the things that are coming. Tell us the future and the events that are going to take place. It's ridicule. You name, you rival gods, you name coming events. Verse 8, do not tremble, don't be afraid, speak up. Have I not long since announced it to you and declared it? You are my witnesses. Is there any God besides me? Or is there any other rock? I know of none. And then he goes in and begins to really ridicule those that fashion the graven image and those that hammer it out, those that shape the wood, and points out that you come down, a very pitiful thing, you come down to verse 17. The rest of it he makes into a god, his graven image. He falls down before it and worships. He also prays to it and says, deliver me, for thou art my God. In the essence, nothing happens. Okay, back to 1 Kings now. It's an interesting passage. Read it all the way through if you get a chance. If you find Bible reading worth your time. Okay. And now, two things remain. Elijah's success. And we'll find him successful in four areas. Verses 30 through 40. Number one, success at the altar. Verses 30 through 35. The question has been asked, is Jehovah God or is Baal God? And I want you to notice in these verses, by the way, to the question, is the Lord God or is Baal God? Notice Elijah does not provide the answer. God answers it himself. That's important. Elijah does not argue the answer. He allows God to answer for himself. So verse 30. Then Elijah said to all the people, come near to me. And this has got to be dramatic. The two sacrifices are set up. We haven't had the fire yet, so get close. So all the people came near to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord, which had been torn down. He picks up the stones and makes it in the following verses. Then verse 33, he arranged the wood and cut the oxen pieces and laid it on the wood. And he said, fill four pitchers with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood. Question. You got a problem there with this request? It hasn't rained for 3.5 years. Where in the world are they going to get water? Turn on the faucet? Well, it's very interesting there. Where is Carmel? Carmel is right on the edge of the Mediterranean, remember? The Mediterranean had not dried up. The problem was you couldn't use the Mediterranean for drinking water. For what reason? You ever had a drink of ocean water? put your hand in it, it's nice and cool, get a glass. It's delicious. Salt water. Or if you go to Israel and go down to the Dead Sea is the only place where you can, where you can't swim. You can stand up in water. I have a picture of me walking on water. You can just stand like this. You come to about here, and it's a funny feeling. You just walk like you are on a, going down the street, and you, what's funny to see a person standing upright just going like that, like you got a propeller on your backside. You can also see the ladies that shave their legs and arms the night before, because they come out of the water as fast as they went in it. But nonetheless. An interesting thing here is the only place they could get the water would be out of the Mediterranean. And remember, whenever a sacrifice was made and water was used, there had to be one thing that had to be there for a valid sacrifice, all of them. There had to be salt. And therefore, the only thing they had in terms of water available was salt, so they probably got some Mediterranean water, poured on the sacrifice, what made it a valid sacrifice. And so they wet it down thoroughly. Verse 34, he said, "Do it, pour the water and do it a second time." They did it a second time, and he said, "Do it a third time." The priests of Baal have got to be sweating at this point. I mean, we've got a nice dry pile of wood over here that'll burn. And what is wrong with this crazy Elijah? He's soaking it down. It's not going to burn. Well, this will make the display obviously all the more dramatic. Verse 35, the water flowed around the altar. He also filled the trench with water. Then it came about at the time of the offering, the evening sacrifice, that Elijah the prophet came near and said. And that is going to be our second area of success. He was successful at the altar. He has success in prayer. And there's a reason why he was successful. That is going to be in verses 36 through 38. Let's read the prayer and notice two things about it. Verse 36. Then it came about at the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice that Elijah the prophet came near and said, now notice carefully the prayer, came near and said, "O Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, today let it be known that Thou art God in Israel, and that I am Thy servant, and that I have done all the things at Thy word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that the people may know that Thou, O Lord, art God, and that Thou hast turned their heart back again." Two things are involved in the prayer of Elijah, two concerns. Number one, an upfront concern, was concern for the glory of God. That is pivotal. Concern for the glory of God. Second, and in the latter part of verse 37, is a concern for the salvation of Israel. Question, in what order do they come? Is he concerned, first of all, for the salvation of man or the glory of God? And notice that the prayer is literally permeated with the idea, prove that you are God. Your glory, your honor is what's at stake. And as a result of the glory of God, something is going to happen as a spinoff, and it will be the salvation of men. So the order is important that these two things are here. Notice, by the way, in the latter part of verse 37, when he says that thou hast turned their heart back again, Elijah knows something. If a heart ever gets changed, God will have to do it. And it's not his argument. It's not trying to convince them. It's, Lord, display your glory, and the heart of man can be changed. All right, following that then, we have his success with Israel. Verse 38. Says, then fire of the Lord fell, consumed the burnt offering, the wood, the stones, and the dust, and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces, and they said, the Lord, He is God, the Lord, He is God. And finally, we will have his success over the Balaam prophets. over the false prophets. In verse 40, then Elijah said to them, seize the prophets of Baal, do not let one of them escape. So they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and slew them there. The major thing I want to say about verse 40 is the actions of Elijah in verse 40 are obedience to God's word. This is not Elijah saying, I won, I'm hacked off, I'm going to kill the other guys. That is not the flavor at all. Elijah had to do what he did in verse 40, or he would have been disobedient. How do we know that? How can we prove this was obedience? By going to Deuteronomy 13. He had to do this if he was obedient. I don't know whether he liked it or not. That wasn't the point. The point was he had to do it. And if he didn't do it, he would have been disobedient. Deuteronomy 13, verses 6 through 10. Here's the law in regard to anybody who introduces gods other than Jehovah. Verse 6, if your brother, your mother's son or daughter, or the wife you cherish, or the friend who is as your own soul, entice you secretly, saying, let us go and serve other gods whom neither you nor your fathers have known, of the gods of the people who are around you, near you, or far from you, from one end of the earth to the other, and you shall not yield to him or listen to him, and your eye shall not pity him, nor shall you spare or conceal him, but you shall surely kill him. What is the major concern? The glory of God or the life of man? Interesting, isn't it? In this context, and it's necessary to understand in the Old Testament, a very important thing, and it's the thing we tend to lack today, and that is this. The glory of God is more important than the life of man. The glory of God is more important than the life of man. And there's no way you can get around the teaching of Deuteronomy 13 if the dearest person you have ever known, your best friend, says, let's depart from Jehovah, take their life. Now, the Old Testament is you get a sense of a little red blood flowing through this, don't you? Little vitality in it, and the only way you can explain it is by this statement, is that there is nothing more important than the glory of God. Now, let's close out with a little comparison. Go back to 1 Kings chapter 16. And let me point out a recurrent theme that you have over and over as the kings come to the throne. Remember, the first king of Israel was Jeroboam. And we want to put, in closing, Jeroboam, his philosophy of life, side by side with Elijah, his philosophy of life. In 1 Kings chapter 16, verse 26, and I'll not point out all of these to you because you can pick them out. As a new king comes to the throne, in verse 26 it says, he, the new king, walked in all the way of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and in his sins, which he made Israel sin, provoking the Lord God of Israel with their idols. So you go clear back to the split of the kingdom, and you have Jeroboam, his sin, followed by the next king, who the text says he walked in the sins of Jeroboam, followed by the next king who walked in the sins of Jeroboam, and we went back and looked at some of the problems with Jeroboam. Let's go back, in essence, in closing, and see what kind of man he was out of chapter 12. The philosophy of Jeroboam was very simple. Here is his mentality. He believed that man was more important than God. That was his mentality. He believed that man was more important than God. And when we talk about he believed that man was more important to God, what particular man did he believe was more important than God? Me. Okay. Chapter 12, verse 27. Remember, the kingdom has split, and he's concerned for himself. Verse 26, Jeroboam said in his heart, and notice his philosophy, "Now the kingdom will return to the house of David if the people go to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem. Then the heart of the people will return to their Lord, even Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they will kill me." What's he saying? I've got to do something to preserve my own importance and my own place because I believe in my mentality I am more important than God. And I do not want the people returning to God. That is the sin of Jeroboam. Until we come to Elijah and what is 1 Kings 17, verse 40, or 18 rather, verse 40, what is it saying? It is Elijah saying, God is more important than man. And by the way, until we have that approach, and until we have that philosophy, man is never in his right place. Man cannot be happy as long as he makes himself the center and circumference of everything. Man's happiness is found in the philosophy of Elijah, that God is important, his glory is what is vital, and with that there is blessing to the people. How can we prove that? Well, in 1 Kings chapter 18, God is glorified, he is seen as God, and what happens for the farmers in Israel? It rained, and their crops grew. Now we'll look Wednesday at the next section of this, which will be Elijah's prayer, which is down at verse 41 through 46, and we'll find some very interesting things here about his prayer. Let me leave you with a few questions. If you'll read 41 through 46, where he prays for rain, make this observation. What did he pray? And if you look throughout verses 41 through 46, there's nothing there about the content of his prayer. And what does that mean? That means there must be some other emphasis than that. Second, as he prays, he sends this servant boy out to go and check and see if there are any clouds in the sky. Why didn't he look for himself? Why did he have to send someone else? And as he is praying, keeps asking the boy to go back and check seven times or six times, was he checking up on God? I mean, was he doing this? Was he sitting here with his head between his knees, praying like this with his head covered, and every once in a while he, you know, looks like, is that what he's doing? Is he checking to see if it's going to really rain? Well, we'll try to answer some of those things on Wednesday in our next study, which will be the prayer of Elijah. And then we will find in chapter 19 that poor guy absolutely goes to pieces. He goes to the pits. I think the event of chapter 18 was too much for him. He couldn't take the publicity. And he does the first thing that he is not told to do anywhere in the narrative. For the first time, he goes to Jezreel, and God said nothing about going to Jezreel. And at that point, he will absolutely go spiritually blind because there will be a threat to his life. He will lose sight of God, he will see nothing but himself, and he will become suicidal, ready to die. And therefore, we'll see this man in a very, very real sense in chapter 19 going into depression and how God deals with him in that context. We'll pick it up in our next few studies. Father, thank you tonight for your word, for this man, Elijah. We're thankful that you are God. We're thankful that you are not silent, even though many times we do not see the drama that we see in this chapter. It's a very rare thing. And yet we tend to assume, because God does not answer by fire, that God is not, and that because he can be ignored, he can be ignored safely. And may we recognize that you are long-suffering, you are patient, and you will allow us many times to go our own way. And we can do it, but we can never do it securely, and we can never do it safely. And therefore, may we learn these lessons from this man's life in Christ's name.